Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
Hi everyone. Thanks for listening in to the latest episode of the Liver Foundation podcast. Thanks to our listeners who have been with us so far. I'm Dr. Margaret Teng. I'm from the National University Health System in Singapore. And I have with me today Professor Sohatis. He's from the Institute for Liver and Digestive Health from the Royal Free Hospital in the United Kingdom. And he has recently been the last author of a recently published article in The Lancet. And this article is entitled Implementation of a Liver Health Check in People with Type 2 Diabetes. So welcome, Prof, to this podcast, and we're really, really happy that you are on here today to discuss your thoughts on this very important topic with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and it's great to be here and have this discussion.
Great. So maybe we can start off by setting the stage for our discussion. So Prof, I think you also mentioned this in your article. What's the burden of metabolic associated steatotic liver disease in our patients with type 2 diabetes?
It's difficult to know exactly, but there are different studies with different methods, and a consensus is that it is around 70%. So 70% of people with type 2 diabetes will have a fatty liver.
I see. And I think you also mentioned, in your article, you also mentioned that actually there's a bi-directional relationship between fatty liver and diabetes. And I found that actually quite interesting. Perhaps you could explain a little bit, is it something synergistic? Do patients with diabetes, how many of them eventually go on to develop fatty liver? And also, likewise, is it very common for patients with fatty liver to have diabetes?
So as risk factors accumulate, people with type 2 diabetes have a risk even if they don't have a baseline, they have a risk of developing fatty liver. And again, we know that people with fatty liver are at higher risk of developing diabetes. And this is because lipotoxicity, which is prevalent in fatty liver, induces hepatic insulin resistance, and then this can generate uncontrolled gluconeogenesis and then contribute to type 2 diabetes. So if we look at people with MASLD, the incidence rate of type 2 diabetes is double compared to people who don't have MASLD.
Wow, that's a really astonishing figure. And is that probably, I guess that's one of the reasons why you chose to, or rather this your group chose to focus on patients with diabetes to implement this liver health check or liver health screening? Because I think thus far, there's actually not been any recommendation for screening for liver fibrosis in any, not in the general population or in any subpopulation as well. So yes, I would like to kind of understand a bit more on your thoughts about this. Why did you all choose to focus on patients with DM, and also what is the proposed liver health check? Could you maybe elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. So what happens at the moment is that liver disease is diagnosed incidentally. So there is no organized way, coordinated way, at looking at people who have risks for liver disease. Usually we diagnose liver disease either by abnormal liver blood tests that are incidentally done for something else, or when someone has an ultrasound and they see a bit of fat in the liver, but the ultrasound is done for another purpose. This is not good enough. Because if we look at patients who present with decompensated cirrhosis, half of them have never had a diagnosis of liver disease before. And when they present with decompensated cirrhosis, it is already too late for most of them. So something needs to fundamentally change, and we need to make this diagnosis earlier. Also, because once we make an early diagnosis, then we can potentially prevent the progression to cirrhosis and decompensation. So this is the rationale. Liver disease is asymptomatic when it is not cirrhotic, and we don't have any method to diagnose it early. So this needs to change. How do we change this? We need to look at which are the groups where the prevalence of liver disease is highest, because this is where it makes sense to focus. And we need to be a bit opportunistic about this early diagnosis and screening. For instance, in type 2 diabetes, there is already a framework of annual checkups. So the framework is already there. And what you can do is you can plug in the liver health check. And it ticks all the boxes, because advanced fibrosis is prevalent in type 2 diabetes. We think that up to 20%. Different studies show different figures. But if you look at the mean value, approximately 20% will have FibroScan values, high FibroScan values, indicating potentially advanced fibrosis. And there is an existing framework, so we can implement a liver health check there. And they don't need additional tests from what they usually do, because we start with a FIB4, and I can talk about that.
Yeah, that's precisely the next question I was going to kind of ask you. Could you perhaps maybe explain a little bit? So I think you mentioned that this is going to be done in the framework of the annual screening, like annual health screening or annual review for type 2 diabetics. And what would you precisely, like the exact mechanism or exact thing that you recommend for, primary care physicians or endocrinologists perhaps, to check as part of this liver health check? Maybe you could elaborate a bit on that.
Yes, so the first step would be to use the FIB4 score. The FIB4 is derived from commonly available variables. So you need age, ALT, AST, and platelet count, and you can also automatically calculate it. So if you ask your lab to automatically calculate FIB4, then they can report it as they do with GFR when you measure creatinine. And so it is inexpensive, it is easy to use and interpret, and it has a low cutoff and a high cutoff. The low cutoff can rule out with a very high negative predictive value people who do not have advanced fibrosis. So you can reassure people that they don't have advanced fibrosis. And if we look at studies in primary care in diabetic populations where they use the FIB4, 80% of patients would be reassured with this simple score. 80%, which is a very good number. And then 20% would need further investigations. And you can also rationalize your screening. If you have people with very significant comorbidities, then you don't need to do the FIB4 score there, because their prognosis will be dictated by their comorbidities. So it's not, obviously it's not for everyone.
Yeah, so actually I had this thought. I mean, and I think you also kind of brought it up in the review itself, the article itself. FIB4 is mainly for, it was developed mainly for people aged 35 to 65. I think my questions would be then in this case, I mean, we see in our clinics patients with fatty liver, other metabolic comorbidities, and then they are below the age of 35 or perhaps above the age of 65. What then do we do for this group of patients?
So below the age of 35, if there is no alcohol in the mix, you don't have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis from a fatty liver. It comes at an older age. So below the age of 35, you don't need to test. Above the age of 65, they are using a higher FIB4 cutoff, a cutoff of 2. Because if you remember, age is a component of the FIB4. So you need to adjust your cutoff. But then you also need to think, would my patient benefit from a liver health check? Would an 80-year-old patient benefit from a liver health check? So you need to rationalize this a little bit. But I would say that, for patients between 40 and 65, 70, you need to do this universally. You can save a lot of lives.
Definitely, definitely. So I think once the primary care physician does a FIB4 and then it comes back as indeterminate, whatever cutoff you're using, whether it's 1.3 or 2 for those who are above the age of 65, then what's the next step for them? For the patient, I mean.
Yeah, they need a second line non-invasive test. And this very much depends on the country where you practice and what is available. The patient can have a FibroScan, or the patient can have a serum test. Like you have the ELF test, you have the fibrometer, you have the HEPA score. There are various tests that a patient can have. I think we need to it we need to move, and we need to create testing capacity so that these tests do not necessarily need to happen in a hepatologist's office. That these tests can be can happen in primary care, in community diagnostic centers. Or that these serum tests are available in endocrinologists and primary care. You can
Yes.
also almost have what we have done in our region. In primary care, once a FIB4 is above 1.3, there is reflex testing for an ELF. So the patient does not need to come back to the office, but they use the blood from that was initially drawn for the FIB4 to calculate the ELF. But we need to create the solutions. We have a problem. We now have an effective treatment for muscle with fibrosis, and we just need to find the patients.
Indeed.
We can't prevent, we can truly prevent liver-related morbidity and mortality, but we can't do unless we diagnose the patients.
That's a really good point. Actually, I wanted to ask, I mean, I think in our part, or at least in Singapore, we don't really have the ELF available, so we use the FibroScan instead. And I think this is also quite commonly used in the United States and many parts of the world. And I do see some gaps in the algorithm. So, like, okay, so I think firstly, I mean, just for those patients who, for example, they have high FIB4 but a low liver stiffness measurement. Right, on the that means the FIB4 was potentially not that accurate. Then what would you recommend that these group of patients do? Should we take the low liver stiffness measurement as being more accurate at picking up the fibrosis than the FIB4 per se, or in should, how often do we need to retest these patients? What's your take on this, Prof? Yeah.
So, a FIB4 of above 1.3 is not high. It's indeterminate. So
Okay.
you do need to trust the FibroScan values. It just tells you that the patient needs further testing. So yes, you need to trust the FibroScan values. And I would read, you know, it takes 7 years for patients to progress of one fibrosis stage if the risk factors remain the same. So I think you can safely ask the patient to be tested in 3 years.
Great. And I think you also mentioned the other you know issue with FibroScan or ELF test, which is that sometimes these tests are not really available, especially in some countries with more limited resources, right? And what is your take on this? You know, this the fact that FibroScan may not be universally available in these cases. You know, it will be difficult to introduce this the proposed liver health check, right? And
yeah.
So how do you think you know we can go about scaling up the use of FibroScan or scaling up the availability of FibroScan in such circumstances?
Well, this will be very difficult. You know, you need the resources. You can't do it without the resources. And you cannot also biopsy all those who have FIB4 above 1.3. You know, at some point you need to decide as a healthcare system what investment you are willing to make in your population, and what are your priorities. But things cannot happen magically.
Prof, in your experience, do you know if I mean, I know you've done a lot of work on the two-step algorithm, you know, the one where, you know, the in the community where they get a FIB4 done first and then a FibroScan. And then now we are talking about having this what we would call a direct access FibroScan. Actually, that is something that you know, in my hospital we are trying to look into introducing, but we meet a lot of I wouldn't say resistance, but more like you know, a lot of difficulties, challenges in convincing the primary care providers to actually, you know, agree to do that, and also the interpretation of the FibroScan results. So that's just my comment on this. I think you are right. There are a lot of things that we need to consider, and I think we need to engage our primary care physicians or endocrinologists when we are trying to, you know, roll out some of these initiatives. Have you ever, you know, heard of or, you know, thought about doing something like a direct access FibroScan for these primary care providers?
Yeah, so we now have we are now establishing a community diagnostic center. And patients will go there directly for FibroScans, and we provide the funding for that. So it's the burden is not in primary care. So patients who have FIB4 scores which are indeterminate and high ELFs will be able to have a FibroScan in the community diagnostic center. And I think, you know, this is the future, that FibroScans will become much more available and much more accessible, and we will be able to increase the access of patients to this test.
In your experience, so can I just ask a bit more on that? You know, so is it like once the patient has a liver stiffness measurement of 8 or more, then they get a kind of reflex referral to a hepatologist, or how does it work?
Yes, so once they have a high stiffness, they come to the hepatologist.
Okay.
And the way we structure our clinic is, you know, in 10 minutes you cannot give advice to a patient about his or her diet, the metabolic comorbidities, the liver, it is impossible. So we have a multidisciplinary clinic, and this is the only way to treat the patient holistically. And in my setting, I have a dietitian where we can offer a package of either a single dietetic appointment or four dietetic appointments, which offer a structured dietetic advice. And I also have a cardiovascular specialist who looks at the cardiovascular risk of patients and can make adjustments to diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and hypertension. And then they also have the consultation with me. And we have a clinical nurse specialist who coordinates. And we also have access to clinical trials. And I think in that way, there is a one-step shop for patients where they can have everything in one go, and a solution and a management plan.
Yes, that sounds like probably the quite an ideal way to practice, but of course that will require a lot of resources and involvement of other subspecialties and allied health as well. Just wanted to ask you on the flip side, you know, we are talking about this two-step sequential algorithm. I think that has also been published in the American and European guidelines, I think AGA and etc. But you know, I think on the flip side, there was also a very, very recent publication. I think you were one of the co-authors in JAMA, which looked at the liver fibrosis scores, non-invasive fibrosis scores in I think 16 over 1,000 patients and in multi-center. And then it did show that, you know, the AGEL 3 plus AGEL 4 looked to be the best. Do you think that in those patients who already have access, for example, those who are already in the tertiary care setting and they have access, easy access to FibroScan, then we should, you know, look towards doing this directly rather than this two-step algorithm, which would then be more applicable in the community setting. What are your thoughts on this, Prof?
So the FIB4 only applies to a primary care setting. It does not apply in secondary care. It applies because the cutoff that we use is the low cutoff, which is to rule out patients who do not have advanced fibrosis. Once patients are in secondary care, it means that there has been some sort of a pre-selection process. So FIB4 would be less useful there, and we should be using biomarkers that have greater accuracy, such as FibroScan, the Agile scores, serum biomarkers, shear wave elastography, MR elastography. Now the Agile scores are a combination of liver stiffness with variables such as age, BMI, presence of diabetes. And in terms of diagnostic accuracy, they have similar diagnostic accuracy with liver stiffness if you use them as dual cutoffs, but result in less indeterminate results. So their utility is that they result in less indeterminate results. And of course, as we showed in our JAMA paper, they also have a very good prognostic discrimination.
Great. That was just some, I think, something interesting that I would have been kind of nice to discuss, but you're right. I don't think it's we may not be able to do that in a primary care setting. Just a few last questions. But what do you think are some of the barriers to uptake of this proposed liver health check, and how do you think that we can help to overcome these barriers?
I think we will need data on cost effectiveness. I think we will need data on implementation. So at the moment, we have a theoretical framework, but we need to see how this will work in practice. Is this going to be cost effective? This will vary according to healthcare systems, but it makes sense. I don't think that it is an opportunity that we should not be missing, and I'm very glad that international guidelines are starting to align on this. And when the first non-invasive test came out, if you think of it, it took 20 years to come to the point where we are now, that there is sufficient validation, that people are using it, and now it is the next stage. We know that they work. We must make them part of our routine clinical practice at a wide scale, so that there are benefits, not just for the patients who come to the hepatology clinics, but for the general population. Liver disease is preventable. We just
Yes.
need to know about it to prevent it.
Yes. So I think that's a really good message, a key message, I think, to kind of end off this discussion with. I think thanks a lot, Prof, for sharing your insights on this topic and also helping to raise awareness of liver disease, which definitely I think now with the advent of the availability of treatment. The recent availability of treatment, I think you're right, this is something that we really need to work on as a community and try to improve our case finding. Any last words or last comments, Prof, before we close this discussion?
No. Thank you very much for the invitation. It was great to be here.
Yeah, so thank you very much, Prof Sohatis. And we are really, really grateful that you took the time to come on this interview and share with us your expert opinion and insight. So thanks once again. And also to our listeners, we hope to see you again at the next podcast. Thank you very much.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.